Hello, everybody. My name is Eric Mann. I'm the co-host of this new show, Voices from the Frontlines, which will be running every Monday from 4 to 5 on KPFK 90.7. Every show has to have a particular angle, and ours is explicitly dedicated to reconstructing a U.S. and a world left. Of course, to be defined, to be continued, what is the world left? That's part of what the show is going to try to figure out. The show is going to focus on strategy and tactics, social movements, radical and revolutionary thinkers, strategists and organizers. We're going to ask the question, what should we do? Or as Vladimir Ilyich, more than John Lennon, asked, what is to be done? Voices from the Frontlines is going to focus the question posed by delegates at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, and the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg. What are we going to do about the United States? Because we see the United States as an empire, and so we're seeking thinkers and leaders throughout the world, with a particular emphasis on leaders of third world nations, as well as oppressed peoples inside the U.S.
Hello, this is your other co-host, Damon Azali. When we look around these days, we see there's a lot of despair. The movement is at a very low level. There's a lot of people saying what we need to do without giving us a plan of how we get there. And so that's where this show is coming from, is trying to get to the plan of how to get there. We are greatly appreciative to KPFK for giving us this chance to help build such an important institution and hope that you will help us build a wide audience as we begin this experiment. So as a guy named Ed Sullivan used to say, who was pretty much before most of your times and also before my time, today we have a really big show. Or as folks would say today, we think we have a bomb-ass show, but we'll let you make up your mind. So today's guest, we're going to be bringing you Robin D.G. Kelly, who's a professor of African-American studies at Columbia University, Natiba Lopez, who's the president of the Mexican-American Political Association, and finally we're going to be joined by Tracy Richards, who's a picket captain for the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770.
I'm Eric Mann, and I'm here today with Robin D.G. Kelly, formerly professor of anthropology, Afro-American studies, and jazz studies at Columbia University. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. You know, when you and I originally talked about doing this interview, I was thinking, since I've read a lot of your books, should we start with Hammer and Hoe, your excellent study of the Alabama Communist Party and the role of blacks in the communist movement? Should we go to Race Rebels and the terrific essay about the struggles on the bus? Should we do Your Mama's Dysfunctional? But since you're very prolific and the show isn't yet our 9-hour marathon, I decided that we would focus on, I know, an area that we both have a great deal of common concern about, which is the issue of reparations for both black people in the United States, Africans throughout Africa, and those throughout the African diaspora. And focusing on your particular chapter in one of your new books, Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. Let me frame it this way. I think you know in the book that I did, Dispatches from Durban, First-Hand Commentaries on the World Conference Against Racism and Post-September 11th Movement Strategies, I actually want to read what was passed in Africa and why the United States walked out to frame this conversation. Because a lot of our listeners, you know, they sort of know black people want reparations, but I don't think they understand the complexity of what this discussion is about. So, for instance, it says that we recognize the transatlantic slave trade and slavery, which constitute crimes against humanity, forced the brutal removal and the largest forced migration in history, over 100 million people, caused the death of millions of Africans, destroyed African Americans, African civilizations, impoverished African economies, and formed the basis for Africa's underdevelopment and marginalization, which continues to this day. We acknowledge that Africa was dismembered and divided among European powers, which created Western monopolies for the continued exploitation of African natural resources for the benefit of Western economies and industries. And then what's interesting is they have a whole set of demands that I won't go into, but for instance, we call and demand the United States, Canada, and those European and Arab nations that participated and benefited from the transatlantic slave trade to create an international compensatory mechanism. They call for restitution for land, for the repatriation of artifacts and artwork, psychological treatment, medical treatment, money. I think one of the things in this show is we're going to focus on the issue of demands, not to our listeners, why are you for or against reparations, but the whole question of demands. Now, in your book, there's two people I wanted to talk about that I think a lot of our listeners might not know about. One is this Queen Mother Audley Moore and her background, and the second I want to get into afterwards is the Black Manifesto in 1969. And to show the tradition of reparations and, as you said, the intersection of Black nationalism and socialism in terms of both of them.
Right.
Why don't you tell us a little bit first about Queen Mother Audley Moore and what you think her impact would be on today's demand development around reparations movement?
Queen Mother Moore is very interesting in that she has roots both in the Garvey movement and in the communist movement. She actually began very early on as a teenage Garveyite and then joined the Communist Party in Harlem in the 1930s and was very active really in the streets around unemployment issues and African Americans who were being thrown out of their apartments and tenement houses, you know, fighting for the right to have a place to stay in the midst of evictions. And so she has this left background. She eventually breaks from the Communist Party around 1950 and in some ways turns back to a Black nationalist agenda, although you can argue that it was always there. And she moves to Philadelphia and is very involved in really building an autonomous African-American political organization and comes across the idea of reparations right around 1962. And her story is that she was reading a Methodist encyclopedia that said something about that people should demand compensation within 100 years after some horrible thing has happened, in this case, slavery. And so she felt like the Emancipation Proclamation was coming up, and that's when she formed an organization called the Reparations Committee of Descendants of U.S. Slaves, Incorporated, and issued a demand for reparations as partial compensation for slavery and Jim Crow. And this is important because, first of all, slavery was important, but slavery wasn't the end-all. You know, it was only part of what African Americans ought to be compensated for. And secondly, money was only part of the compensation. It would be more than that. And what she demanded at that point, her and her organization, was $500 trillion to be spread over the next four generations. And what's interesting to me in her demands was it wasn't just a transfer of money to be paid out to individuals who are descendants of slaves. She put a lot of emphasis on creating a democratic structure so that the people who are to receive the money can decide what to do with the money. You know, the money wasn't going to be controlled by a little clique or controlled by kind of the Black bourgeoisie or Black middle class. And she said in later interviews, the last thing she wanted was a poverty program. She wanted the government to transfer this fund in the hands of Black people who are going to decide how to rebuild their communities. And I think that's a very, very important part of her claim and her outlook. And this is a position she had been pushing up until her death. And I believe she died in the early 90s, but she lived a long time.
Well, before I go on to the Black Manifesto, why would a Black nationalist join the Communist Party in the 1930s? Why would someone go from the Garvey movement and be attracted to Black communism? And where's the nationalism in there? Does she give up her nationalism, or is there some attraction around the Communist Party in the 1930s for Black nationalists as well?
That's a very good question, because Audley Moore was one of many, many Garveyites in Harlem who had joined the Communist Party. And there's a couple reasons. Probably the most important reason was that the Communist Party's position on Black people had changed pretty dramatically after 1928 when they pushed for what was called the Black Belt Thesis, or they argued that Black people, particularly in those counties in the South where Black people are a majority, have a right to self-determination. And this is the position that came out of struggle inside the Soviet Union, led largely by African and African-American communists, specifically Harry Haywood, who was in the Soviet Union and the Communist International at their Sixth World Congress, and then there's a man named James Laguma, South African communist, who had pushed a similar position for South Africa, except in the case of South Africa, the whole nation is the Black Belt. You know, it's like Africa for the Africans. And their ideas in some ways came very close to what Garvey had promoted, because Garvey had a very strong anti-imperialist agenda. The difference is that they were anti-imperialist and they were socialists. They didn't want to sort of reproduce capitalism in what would be the independent nations or the self-determined nations, although they did insist that black people have the right to choose their path. And I think that the power of the Garvey movement was so huge, the Communist Party just could not ignore it. And the fact that these black Garveyites came into the Communist Party reshaped the culture of that movement. So in some ways it became a place that was somewhat comfortable in some ways, not entirely, but somewhat comfortable for black nationalists. The other thing that happened was in 1935, Italy invades Ethiopia. And this was one of the most important anti-imperialist struggles in the 20th century, really, because it was the beginning of World War II. It was an affront not just to Africa, but to a part of Africa that has all this biblical significance, with, you know, Psalm 68 of the Bible, you know, about Ethiopia shall stretch forth their arms. And so Ethiopia was very, very important, you know, to African Americans. You had at least 8,000 black people, mostly black men, mobilizing and volunteering to go to Ethiopia to fight Italy when the U.S. wasn't really doing anything about it. Most of the Western nations weren't so interested in Ethiopia as well. So that was the context for why so many African Americans end up, particularly former black Garveyites. One other thing I should add, though, is that the Garvey movement itself had pretty much been crushed by the late 20s. And so these were activists who were looking for an organization to join and looking to rebuild some of the kind of organizational and political spirit that was foundational to the Garvey movement.
This is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7, talking with Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of anthropology, Afro-American studies, and jazz studies at Columbia University, discussing his book, Freedom Dreams, the issue of reparations in the black left. Let's go now to the Black Manifesto in 1969, another interesting effort at the synthesis of black nationalism and socialism. The National Black Economic Development Conference, James Forman, a very mercurial, complicated political figure, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. This is when I was involved in the movement. This was a big thing. The issue of reparations became very immediate. They were accused of course, threatening white Christian churches, which they did, in the good sense of that. I was looking in your book again, in Freedom Dreams, in the chapter on reparations, and just quickly, they demanded, first of all, not enough money, $500 million, but interesting, look at the common themes: funds, land, a Southern land bank, a national black strike fund, funds to the National Welfare Rights Organization, which were led by black women, the concept of black publishing houses in New York, Atlanta, Detroit, and L.A., a black television networks, and I don't think they anticipated BET, National Research Center, National School for Organizers, and a black university in the South. Give Forman credit in particular, I mean, with all his many weaknesses, a great demand developer, don't you think? And
absolutely,
since one of your tremendous strengths is your research, let's talk about some of those demands and their impacts on the reparations movement today.
It's a real remarkable document. When I went back and read it to write this book, and I'd read it before, but I guess I wasn't paying attention, I was amazed by the broad vision, and the vision wasn't even just national, it was international. Let's sort of begin by talking about the land bank. Land was something that we often take for granted, especially in thinking about the middle and late 60s when you think of the African American community as an urban community. But the struggle for self-determination and the struggle that black nationalists were waging really from the 30s on, and especially in the 50s and 60s, was for rights to land. Land as property, land as self-sustaining, land as territory, you know, and this actually supported the nation thesis that, you know, black people really did constitute a nation. Although part of the argument was that, you know, where is that nation? Some of the critics of that position said the nation is really inside the city, you know, and this is people like James Fox put forward that idea. But nevertheless, imagine if you had a land bank, and connect that to like the most recent struggle, somewhat of a victory, of black farmers who sued the federal government for having the land taken away over the, I think it was over, I forget the total amount, but it was millions of dollars that ended up, you know, collectively going to this lawsuit. And this is very recent. And so in a sense, Foreman and others who drafted the Black Manifesto, people in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, recognized how important land was historically to black people and what value it carried. I mean, imagine if people could hold on to the land just in terms of an investment. One of the reasons why you have the post-war suburban miracle for whites is because of land and property. The property that they were able to get both through FHA loans, through the VA bill, through the way in which race values white property versus, you know, black or Latino property. I mean, these are kind of things that, you know, are the source of wealth accumulation. And so I think they recognize that. If you go down and talk about what it meant to put aside $20 million for a national black labor strike fund, I mean, it's recognizing that, that the black community is a largely working class community and that it's not enough to just receive funds and then live off those funds and everyone lives happily ever after. You have to have a sustained, organized resistance and a sustained, organized form of protection. And the drafters of the Black Manifesto recognize that. So to be able to say that we're going to have this labor strike fund that's over and above what the unions have, you know, and the fact that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers were involved in the drafting of this document is, I think, a sign of why labor was so important in formulating these demands. The other thing is that, again, you mentioned National Welfare Rights Organization. Just imagine what would have happened had the National Welfare Rights Organization had received a $10 million subsidy to do their organizational work. I mean, they wouldn't have collapsed when they did. They would have continued and built, I think, a really strong organization. And right now, as the safety net totally being eroded, the kinds of protections that poor people, particularly poor women of color, have depended on are just disappearing. This is the kind of organization that would have protected their rights.
You know, I think one of the things interesting is because there's always been a struggle between the black intellectual tradition and the black anti-intellectual tradition. Look at how many demands here are focusing on the role of theory, ideology, and education from publishing houses, television networks, research centers, schools for organizers, and a black university. As a black intellectual and as a black academic, I know you faced, you know, even though you're very popular, you faced certainly certain critics, like what do you do in a Columbia or NYU. Why don't you just talk about that? Because a lot of people, when they think of, you know, League of Revolutionary Black Workers, they think of Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, grassroots struggles, but they don't look to how much primacy the black left gave to the intellectual and theoretical part of building a movement.
Absolutely. Over a third of the money was geared towards issues of theory, education, or, for want of a better term, agitprop. You know, in other words, trying to promote a different vision and understanding of African-American life, practice, and thought. So you think, you know, to set aside, I think it was $130 million to establish a black university in the South. Now that does two things. One, it says, here is how important higher education is for developing this community. And secondly, it says, there is no real black university in the South.
Exactly.
I mean, it's funny because you've got all those universities. You've got the Spelmans and the Morehouse and the AUs and, you know, Tougaloo. And these are places that are actually hotbeds of the civil rights movement, for that matter. So it's not like there's no progressive element. But what they're saying is that the kind of education that they're promoting is not education for liberation. So they're saying we want to build a liberation university. And I think that is extremely powerful. And clearly, to build such a university is based on the premise that this is not something that people are going to pay enormous amounts of money to attend. The fact that they included, you know, not just radio stations and publishing houses and television networks, but research skill center that could facilitate the study of not only the problems of black people, but another $10 million to give people training in education, teacher training, photography, movie making, television and radio manufacturing repair. In other words, it was a very broad-based, visionary kind of approach. There's one thing I should add, though, which I think is important and also overlooked, is that the Black Manifesto pushed for an internationalist vision as well. And one of the things that they argued for or planned to demand it was money set aside to support African liberation movement. And that's kind of surprising given the fact that so much of the reparations movement today, not all of it, but a lot of it is really very domestic in its vision. You know, it's about U.S. African Americans. And say that we're going to set aside $20 million to support a United Black Appeal responsible for raising money, part of which will be used to promote the development of cooperatives in African countries and provide material support for African liberation movements. It's astounding.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, at the Strategy Center and also in the book that I wrote, you know, I keep repeating the demand, reparations for Black people in the United States, for the African nations, and those of the African diaspora. I didn't make it up, obviously. I got that at the World Conference Against Racism, and I think that it's just such a weakness of the U.S. left in general, even at its best, if it's trying to make demands, I'd say, within the empire, versus when you go to these international conferences, the incredible liberatory possibilities that become clear, which will segue into the last question, which is, you look at visionary thinkers like Queen Mother Moore and Jim Foreman and many, many others that you've done incredible research on. But let's talk about the dilemma, certainly not unique to the Black movement, but to the left in general, but we're talking about the Black movement, of organizations disintegrating of their own internal contradictions. As you pointed out in your book, 2 or 3 years after the Black Manifesto, Jim Foreman was asked to leave the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, helped to form the Black Workers Congress. There were contradictions there. In many of your books, you describe a lot of these great movements, including in the Black women's movement, but often give their dates of like a year, 2 years of longevity. Looking at today's dilemma, it's not that people have to totally agree on the programmatic influence, but I know you've been trying to be a unity figure in a difficult movement right now. Why don't you tell a little bit about the contradictions in the Black movement, leaving aside for a minute the greater contradictions among whatever happened to the white anti-racist left, which we'll take for granted here, and I assure you we'll address on other shows. But as trying to build the Black United Front, which I know is a high priority to you, how do you address the growing contradictions within the Black movement, and how could the reparations movement hopefully provide some unifying glue to this?
That's an excellent question, and it's difficult because some of the contradictions are old ones that just continue to carry. You see this in the Black Radical Congress. You know, you have a kind of old school cultural nationalism on the one hand, got social democrats on the other, and they were fighting in the late 60s and 70s, and many of the very same people are fighting today, but still trying to build a united front and trying to kind of bury the hatchet, but that's almost impossible. I shouldn't say that. It's difficult. There's that. There are generational contradictions right now, where you have a group of young people in their 20s, some in their early 30s, I don't think they're that young, who are really struggling for leadership, but have been told that they're the youth, and that the youth represent an arm or a wing of a larger movement rather than the movement. And one of the struggles in the BRC when it was first formed was, why do you have a youth caucus of people who are in the late 20s? You know, youth caucus should be 12 to 17 or something like that, you know. So that's one of the contradictions. There's class contradictions, which, you know, go way back, but at every generation they shift, you know, and it's very complicated. I don't think it's any more complicated now, but it's a little different in that you have, you know, your radical petty bourgeoisie who are committed to struggle. Some of these people are tied to universities. Some people have given up what could be lucrative jobs. Some of them are actually working both in the union movement. Others are working for foundations, trying to raise money for organizations. And there's that group. And then you have those who are really grassroots activists who come out of working class urban communities about housing issues. And sometimes they're not at the same table, you know. And it's very difficult when you got students who are very committed, and young people committed to something, but it seemed disconnected from the kinds of local urban struggles that have taken place. I mean, one of the things that I love about the Strategy Center is that you all figured out how to solve the problem, you know, which amazes me that you can have an organization that has both really significant petty bourgeois kind of, you know, intellectuals who are committed to struggle and also committed to subordinating themselves to a movement, and then on the other hand have this large, large, extensive grassroots community across race and language difference. I mean, that's something that I think is a model for a lot of people, but it's very difficult to pull off, you know, and it's difficult to pull off, especially if you don't have, like, a lot of resources to do it.
Well, thanks. And one of the things I know that's unique in your writing a lot, especially as a man, is you do a lot of work around the gender contradiction, in particular women's liberation and the fight against male supremacy in the movement. Why don't you just talk a little bit about that and how your own thinking is evolving on that?
One of the things I argued in Freedom Dreams is that when it's all said and done and you step back and you look at all these different movements that I write about, the movement that probably had the most, the broadest revolutionary potential was radical black feminism. And it's not an accident that, you know, when you look at almost all the other organizations I talk about, that black women were at the heart of doing the grassroots organizing, even if their names don't make it in the history books. But one of the things about radical black feminism is that they were as much concerned about issues of the household, of domestic life, and the problems of domesticity, of interpersonal gender relations, which actually affect organizing work and affect the ability to survive. And so by having an analysis around those issues, in addition to an analysis around the role that capitalism plays, patriarchy on a global scale plays, and racism, you know, that they were poised to give, I think, the movement at large a really revolutionary position, but you know, we know the story. I mean, sexism made it very difficult for these women to be heard and for them to have any kind of institutional presence beyond doing all the work at the grassroots. But, you know, I'm pretty confident that new generations will emerge and that the younger people that I've seen are much better, more savvy in some ways, about dealing with gender and sexuality. The question of gender is the question of sexuality as well, you know. The dynamism of the lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender movement, you know, which I remember when we had these struggles going on in New York around Amadou Diallo, the forefront of the anti-police brutality kind of contingents in those early demonstrations were coming out of black and mixed-race gay and lesbian organizations, you know, even before Sharpton got in it. But, of course, they don't exist. The media, you know, you just kind of get pushed aside. But things are changing. I think I'm hopeful for the future.
This is Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM, interviewing and discussing with Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of anthropology, Afro-American studies, and jazz studies at Columbia University. We'll be right back.
Do you want to influence KPFK programming policy? Come to Pasadena Area FPNN Programming Council Forum on Monday, December 15th. You can meet candidates informally starting at 6 p.m. at the Coffee Gallery, 2029 North Lake, 2 miles north of the 210 freeway in Pasadena. A moderated discussion with questions from the audience will begin at 7 p.m. You may have already received your ballot in the latest folio. Help us choose the best candidates to guide the station's programming policy. Come to 2029 North Lake Avenue, Monday evening, December 15th. For more information, go to www.kpfk.org or call 626-797-0017.
Welcome back. This is Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM. Interviewing and discussing with Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of anthropology, Afro-American studies, and jazz studies at Columbia University. Let me ask you some of the contradictions that you face, because every choice that people make is debatable, and certainly in our movement, no choices, no good deeds go unpunished, and no choices go unscrutinized. So I think what's interesting is some of the criticisms been leveled at you is, of course, why Columbia and NYU? Why do you reach out to white anti-racists? Why do you affirm the Marxist-Leninist tradition within your own thinking, let alone within the historical importance? Why at this point of the fall of communism do you still feel that communism has a relevant role in a future left? And the fourth is, in your effort to focus on cultural studies, do you not, in fact, deny the essentially the role of the base, the role of the economic base, the role of the materialist analysis, and do you trip out on focusing on everyday acts of resistance in a way to denigrate an actual left strategy? I'm sure you've heard many others, but those are four I thought you might want to just give a little voice to and how you understand critiques when you're hearing them.
Let me take the last first and go backwards. I've heard that critique before, and you know, one of the things I try to do, and whether I succeed or not depends on what the readers say, is, well, it's a couple of things. One is always, always base every single, you know, description, social movement, event that I write about within the context of the kind of material conditions. You know, in other words, that even when I do something called cultural studies, and I would argue that most of my work isn't really cultural studies, it's really kind of, you know, social history, political history. But even when I do cultural studies, you know, fundamentally, whether I'm talking about Malcolm X and Zoot Suit, that's all about the conditions of World War II, and it's about labor, and it's about policing, and it's about the kind of international dimensions of democracy, you know, not just about a suit of clothes. And one of the arguments I make when I talk about the importance of the Zoot Suit for Malcolm X is that it's never the article or the cultural manifestation that matters. It's always the context, always the context. There's nothing inherently progressive about a suit. There's nothing inherently progressive about baggy pants. Nothing. They're just pants. But what makes it different is that if the state beats you behind over it, then it means something to the state. Now, then we got to figure out what does it mean and why. And then we start getting into other things like histories of racism and class oppression. So I think my work has always been solidly based on the kind of material conditions. And in fact, I'm very critical of that kind of, particularly certain whiteness studies that are totally disconnected from the issue of racism. I mean, I've read long articles and even books of people who talk about whiteness, 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 and never once talks about racism. You know, whiteness becomes just kind of an alternative identity, when my understanding is that it's all about the construction of racial hierarchies and the reproduction of white supremacy. So there's that. To go back to the question of communism, I know I'll die a Marxist, you know, although I wasn't born one, which is exactly the point. And the reason is because it's hard for me, even 20 years ago, to accept any place in the world as embodying what's possible. I don't think the Soviet Union was the example of how socialism could actually work. I certainly don't think China was an example. Albania, any of these places were examples. They were attempts and efforts, and there was lots of amazing things that came out of these nations. But there were also nations that struggled to create a socialist society within a world capitalist order. You know, and that's almost impossible, difficult, I should say. One of my favorite places in the world was Grenada, and we saw what happened with Grenada. You know, it was just destroyed, crushed under the heel of U.S. imperialism. And that's why we can't even talk about, you know, just sort of building socialism without having an anti-imperialist strategy, because socialism will always be threatened in any nation. But socialism is still the best possibility we have for doing something which to me is more important than just being efficient, and that is remaking humanity. You know, the communist tradition was about trying to make new human beings who cared about one another, you know, human beings who developed a whole philosophy of life around how to make life nice, sweet, easier, and unleash productive and creative forces that are within us. You know, under capitalism, you can't do that, you see. And we don't know what the possibilities are, because I don't think we've had successful socialism to, you know, produce that. And that, to me, is a different question from, not entirely different, but it's partly different from the question of what does it mean to have a Marxist analysis. which I think is also necessary to make sense of the way capitalism works. But that's only part of it. I think it's not enough to say you're a Marxist. You have to say you're a communist or a socialist. You have to say that because that's about the vision of the future. And when I wrote Freedom Dreams, the whole purpose of that book was to say, look, we need to go back to talk about what is it we're trying to build. You know, in addition to our analysis of everyday oppression, what is it we're trying to build? And that's why I insist on being a socialist. One other thing was NYU, Columbia, why I work at those places. You know, I don't really know the answer to that except for the fact that it's very basic. It's like I chose this path of being a scholar in part because of my politics. And I think that the best, most effective way I could do what I do, because I'm not a very good organizer, is to, you know, try to be around people, be around movements, learn from movements, and try to write the books and articles that could be of some use to somebody, somewhere. And Columbia and NYU happen to be in New York City, and this is where I want to be, you know, more than any place else, you know, for personal reasons, because, of course, I'm not just a socialist. But we're always more than what we say we are. So that's the only reason. Of course, people can make the argument that, you know, I ought to be at in the South at Atlanta University or at a community college. And I think that there's certainly a point to that. And but at the same time, you know, in terms of who I reach, who the community students are I deal with, a lot of these students are basically multiracial, working class students who are struggling to get a college education, and many of them are active in movements. And my presence in the university is not limited to the place I'm employed. I'm in every university all over the country trying to deal with people, trying to have conversations, and almost all the talks I give for free, particularly to those institutions that are struggling, you know, financially. And so in a sense, I feel like, okay, this could be my base, but I have an obligation to be other places. And finally, the question of why reach out to anti-racists, why it's, well, I don't know, I feel like, even though I sound optimistic all the time, I still feel like the Titanic has turned over and I'm in that freezing cold water, you know, just floundering. And you reach out to anyone who can, you know, help you. And I think that you always risk, you know, certain compromises when you reach out. But then you also risk compromises when you reach inward, you know. I mean, to work with, you know, certain African-American cultural nationalists who I might feel like I trust could be disastrous, you know. To work with people who you think are supposed to be in your community may turn out badly, just like it turned out for Nat Turner, for that matter. I think that we have to work with anti-racist whites, and more importantly, not only because it builds the alliance and allows us greater support, but it also transforms on both sides. I mean, there are anti-racist whites who have still struggling with questions of racism. And the best way to struggle is to struggle with people who are not other anti-racist whites, but struggle with black people, struggle with Latinos and Asian Americans. I've got to reach out to the Asian American community, to the gay and lesbian community, to the Latino community, to the Native American community, because, you know, we're all here on this earth struggling against forces of capitalism and imperialism. And we all, like, will drown together if we don't somehow build some kind of alliance. But those alliances have to be based on mutual respect and a common vision. Now, a vision that may be full of contradictions, but a vision that's always in motion, you see, if that makes any sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And your modesty about not being a very good organizer, I mean, I think your books are your greatest organizing contribution, and people all over the world are reading them, and you're influencing people tremendously. The number of graduate students, including black graduate students, who you've been working and cultivating and nurturing to get PhDs to go into that hypothetical black revolutionary university in the South, and then the, you know, which we will someday hope to exist, is a tremendous contribution, Robin. And thanks so much for being on the show. And since everybody gives you advice, I think you just came up with your next book, which is I Wasn't Born a Marxist, But I'll Definitely Die One. So I can't wait to read it. This is Robin D.G. Kelly. Okay. Thanks for being on Voices from the Frontlines.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Okay, see you later.
Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of anthropology, Afro-American studies, and jazz studies at Columbia University. We'll be right back.